Well, as you may have heard, former NFL quarterback Joe Capp passed away this week at the age of 85. And when I told my wife about it, she had one response. She said, "Who's Joe Capp?" Now, if you were around in the 1950s, which she was not, or the 1960s, which she was, but she was pretty young, or the 1970s, you wouldn't ask that question. Joe Capp was a star quarterback at Cal, the University of Cal Berkeley, where he led the Golden Bears to a conference championship in 1958 and the Rose Bowl. I think it was against Iowa that year. But then he went on to the CFL, where he won a Grey Cup with the BC Lions in 1964. And from there, he was on to Minnesota, where he replaced Hall of Famer Fran Tarkenton and friend of the show, Fran Tarkenton, and led the Vikings to Super Bowl IV versus Kansas City, where they lost to the Chiefs. Now, ironically, Ira, the GM who brought Joe to the CFL was Jim Finks, who was the same GM, stuff this morning, same GM who acquired him from the CFL and who brought Bud Grant from the CFL to Minnesota. Now, Ira, I'm going to ask you just a simple question. What do you remember about Joe Capp?
I remember his playing style, Clark.
Yep.
Rough and tumble. Rough and
Yeah.
tumble.
Ran over guys, right?
Ran
Ran over
over
guys.
guys, threw the most unorthodox passes in the world. Of course, our guest is going to chime in on it
Yep.
because
Well, you're right.
he helped block, and he watched him.
He
So
not
really
only watched him,
unorthodox.
Ira, he not only watched him, he knew Joe because he was one of his teammates. And I'm talking about former guard Ed White.
And Clark, we got to remember that in 69, when the Vikings reached that Super Bowl, he was the runner-up for the MVP of the league to Roman Gabriel. He was the
Yeah, that's
runner-up.
correct. That's correct. And as I said, today's guest is former offensive guard Ed White, and he's one of the NFL's honestly most accomplished offensive linemen and someone I had the privilege of covering in San Diego, albeit too short, but before he retired after the 1985 season. Ed joins us today from his home in California. And Ed, it's been a long time, but thank you so
You're welcome,
much
Clark.
for
Good seeing
joining
you.
Ira and me.
Ed, I'm going to bring you back to your rookie season, Ed, 1969.
Okay.
And so, Ed, you're watching this rough and tumble guy, Joe Capp. He's a fellow Cal alumni, right? 10 years apart,
Yeah,
Ed,
he's
and
a legend.
a legend. Now, Ed, you weren't playing that much as a rookie, not as a
Well,
rookie.
actually, I'll tell you the story. I was a defensive lineman at Cal. I never played offensive guard. John Michaels, they had the Purple People Eaters, so guess where I ended up? I was an offensive guard, and John Michaels put a lot of effort in me. And what happened was Jim Valone, who was the starting guard, had appendicitis attack in training camp. And I ended up starting the first four games of our Super Bowl year, and we won all four of them, by the way. My first game was against Mr. Bob Lilly, which was an awakening. But my quarterback was Joe, and I got to say, it was a fantastic experience from the standpoint of he didn't treat me as a weak link, as somebody he was worried about. I never felt anything but part of that group, and it was amazing. He sort of took me under his wing. I learned to hate tequila and a few other things, but he was quite a man, and I've always been a good friend.
Ed, that 69 playoff game against the Rams, I remember watching it. I was a teenager. That was a fantastic football game. And they were leading 17-7 at the half, Ed, and the Vikings were the favorite team. They had Gabriel. He had won the MVP that season. Carl Eller turned in a huge play, Ed, a safety. He sacked Gabriel in the end zone. What do you remember about that Rams game, Ed?
Well, the thing I remember most is that we always had a mental edge in terms of when teams from the West Coast came out and played us in our environment. I remember the Chargers going back and playing Cincinnati. You probably remember that, Clark. And we were more worried about the scuba gloves that we had to wear to fight the cold. And you worry more about all of that kind of stuff and not the game. And it was a big advantage playing in the Met outside because we practiced every day in St. Paul outdoors, no matter what the weather was. Bud had us out there. And so we felt it was an advantage, and it was an advantage.
Yeah, Ed, one more quick one before I turn it over to Clark. Ed, by 1970, the next season, I mean, coming off a Super Bowl, Joe Capp is gone. Ed, he's gone. I guess there was some kind of contract dispute. What happened?
Well, there was a contract dispute, and, you know, I don't want to get into that too much, but I can tell you that Jim Finks had a philosophy of payroll integrity, and what he described that was as, Ed White, you're not going to make more than Mick Tinglehoff or Ron Yeary, so guess who got the lowest salary? And the everything was like that, including he just and I love Jim Finks as a manager, but that's where it started. He had it figured out, and guys played, and we were probably the lowest paying team in the league. And but we also knew that we had one of the best coaches that was a player as a coach and took care of his players. We went to training camp last, so we were fresh when it came down to the postseason, and most teams, New Orleans was beat to crap because they'd been going 3 months of training camp, and we were in good spirits and good health, and we appreciated that. And he kept us together, kept the same group of guys together. The whole time I was there, I bet you 80% of the guys were the same guys I came in with.
We're speaking with former offensive lineman Ed White on the eye test for two, and we're talking about Joe Capp, at least for the moment. But Ira, it's funny, he mentioned that about packing up the gear in San Diego and going east. I do remember when I was covering the Chargers a little bit later than when they would load up all that gear, and I said, they're dead. They're dead. When I see the benches going on and the gear and the jackets and everything, they're dead. They've already lost the mental edge because they know they're going into the frozen tundra somewhere where they're going. It's not 75 and sunny. And I always thought that was, Ed, a huge advantage for teams playing either in the Northeast or in places like Green Bay or Minnesota when West Coast teams would come to that environment.
No question. I was a little bit miffed when they went indoors because I know what an advantage it was for us. And playing in that environment.
Ira took you back to your rookie season. I'm going to as well. You played on the Vikings in a game against the defending NFL champion Baltimore Colts that year. And that was a game in which Joe Capp threw for 7 touchdown passes. I think Ira, September 28th, 1969. Do you remember that game? And if you do, what do you remember most about it?
Most about Joe hurdling Lindsay and knocking the linebacker out of the game.
it couldn't have been Mike Curtis. He was too tough to be knocked out.
No, Mike Curtis, no. That would have been a different deal. But, it was incredible. But it just reinforced the kind of guy Joe was. I mean, you know, we laughed about him throwing the duck balls and all that and the wobblers, and we'd quack when they went over the top. And, you know, but you know, he was such a leader. And a champion. I mean, you know, like you said, Clark, the Grey Cups, the Super Bowl, yeah. Cal and the Rose Bowl. And Cal's never been in a Rose Bowl before or since, I don't believe.
No, that's correct.
And you know, he was a natural-born leader, came from, you know, humble beginnings. I think both his mother and father were migrant workers. And I had the pleasure of being, you know, a pretty close friend of Joe's. He had me up to his place up in Salinas, and we spent a lot of time together. I just love the guy. You know, he's just a real person.
Apparently, you weren't alone because he was the team MVP. But as I've heard it, he refused to take the trophy or award because he said there are 4D team MVPs on this club. I'm not the team MVP. All 40 of these guys are.
Yeah, that's. That's true.
Yeah. And you mentioned the unusual situation in 1970, which I do find extraordinary. He played that year really without a future contract. They didn't sign him to an option. I looked at that. So essentially, he became a free agent the following year, and nobody bid on him until the Patriots did during the season. I mean, they signed him in October. You've got the defending NFL champion quarterback, Joe Capp, who's out there as a free agent. And he became then, I think, the highest paid player. But I think what he did then, which was, the Patriots had to surrender 2 first-round draft picks. Pete Rozelle said they had to surrender 2 first-round draft picks in exchange for Joe. But what he did was set the table, it seems to me, for future free agents. And I'm talking about down the road. I mean, because he had an antitrust lawsuit that he eventually won in 77, but not monetarily, but principally, and essentially set the table for the NFL and the NFLPA establishing the free agency system in 1993. Would you agree?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think, a lot of guys have done things to do that. It's just very difficult to fight for more money as an individual. And it just always has been. It was difficult for me. I mean, I had to hold out of training camp 2 years, and were promised certain things that if I came back in, they'd renegotiate. And, it was very difficult and very hard. And I thought maybe my career was over, but I wasn't making that much that I was ready to go do some, be a landscape architect. And I had worked for the city of St. Paul every off season. We all had to have off season jobs. And Grady Alder would come to work with his briefcase. He was a CPA. I mean, it was just, part of the deal. And anymore, they come in with their briefcases, but it isn't to work for somebody.
Well, Ira, one more question I've got for Ed, because when the Patriots drafted Jim Plunkett, he was the first overall pick in 1971, Joe Capp quit. So you've got a guy who's 2 years removed from being a Super Bowl quarterback, and he quit to pursue this antitrust action against, the league, certainly. But and that took until 1977 before it was resolved. But Ed, that's remarkable that somebody who was that, I guess, principled, he was an outstanding talent, not a great passer, but a great athlete. I mean, he played on the Cal basketball team and was a star.
Right.
I mean,
star. Yeah, I think he was all Pac-10.
He was. But he pursued this legal action and eventually ended up winning it. Not a lot of money. In fact, I don't think there was any money involved, but he won the action.
Yeah, and he set the course for future.
That's correct.
Players and the players today, and as we did a property suit, 6 of us, because they were using our likeness at will and not compensating anybody. We didn't make anything, but the players that are playing today have, hopefully they will remember that.
Ed, you played on a lot of outstanding teams in Minnesota and the Chargers. Ed, I'm going to suggest maybe the best team you were on didn't get that far. And I'm talking about 75. You were 12-2 Minnesota. And it's the damn Hail Mary play, Ed.
Oh, gosh.
What's your recollection, Ed, and how heartbroken were you after that game?
Well, we had a fantastic team. You know, our team was ball control and let the defense do their job, and they did, and it was the peak of our defensive. Everybody was at their peak in terms of age and performance, and they were unreal. And we had our offense, probably the best offense that we had in that time period, and I thought we were, going to go all the way, and it just didn't work out. I don't remember why. I guess you shut out all the negative stuff, but I know that it was disheartening at the end of that year.
What do you remember about that Hail Mary from Staubach, Ed?
Oh God, that was the little defensive back from San Diego,
Nate Wright.
Nate, and good. Good guy, good player. I remember seeing it, and I couldn't believe it wasn't a penalty called, and I guess apparently one of the people in the stands couldn't either. Didn't they throw a bottle at the official or something? I can't remember, but I think something came out of the stands. But it was a shame that a game could come down to that, and now, of course, they have the replays and all that, so that hopefully ended that kind of situation. But yeah, it for the season to end on a play like that is kind of unfortunate. And I think we would have probably gone a lot further.
Ed, for a player of your stature on the Vikings, you were entrenched as one of the great guards in the NFL. And then you got traded. Ed, what's the story behind the trade? How stunned were you that it happened?
Well, I'm not a fan of Mike Lynn. I know he's gone, so I don't want to badmouth him. But and he was doing his job. His job was to sign guys as cheap as he could. Unfortunately, I'd gone to several Pro Bowls and realized that I was making about a third of what these guys were making. And payroll integrity was fine, but it wasn't what was going on around the whole league. And I just, I just had to stand up for myself and my family, because I knew that, I'd already played 8-7 years when it started, and then 9 when it ended. And the average guy played about 3.5. So I knew my years were numbered, and fortunately they lasted a little longer, or unfortunately now, and I'm limping around having things replaced. But anyway, I had to do what I had to do for, I did it for not only myself, but for my family. And it ended up fantastic. And I feel good I felt good about coming home. I was born and raised in San Diego. My mom and dad got to watch me finish my career, which was fantastic. And my wife's parents got to come and watch, and it was a good way to end it. It really was. And I enjoyed it. And plus I was so fortunate to have played for 2 Hall of Fame coaches, and each coach was in the Hall of Fame because they knew how to take care of their players. They knew how to move the football. One knew how to move the football better than the other one. The other one knew how to stop it better than the other one. So it was an interesting situation, but I played on an offense that we felt like we could score every time we had the ball. Clark, you watched it.
I did.
It was dynamic. Unfortunately, the defense suffered, and probably suffered because of the way we played the game offensively and practiced against them. And so I can't say they were horrible, but if we had the Minnesota defense with our offense, who knows what we'd have.
A great team, great team. We were with offensive lineman, yeah. Former offensive lineman Ed White on the Eye Test for Two. Ed was a star with the Minnesota Vikings, the San Diego Chargers, and Helix High in San Diego. And
Helix High, yeah.
Cal Berkeley, since you mentioned San Diego, Helix High.
I'm living up near Escondido. That was my first game was against Escondido, and they were like the state champions, and I was playing tight end, and I got my fanny kicked. That was my very first game. They were a bunch of farmers, and God almighty, it was a rude awakening.
Ed, before we get on, I do want to ask you some questions about yourself, but since I already mentioned it, going back to that 1969 team, and that was a really good team too. That was 12-2 in Minnesota. But I remember once talking to Mike Curtis, Mad Dog Curtis, about Super Bowl III, and he still had not lost the rage from losing that game. All those years later, had not lost the anger and the rage, and couldn't even talk about it. What do you remember about Super Bowl IV? I mean, obviously you remember the loss, but how disappointing was it? Have you let go of that? Was it tough to let go of that?
I don't think about it too much, Clark. I try to think about positive things. I know the difference in winning and losing is immense, and the bigger the game, the more immense it is. You work hard and you achieve so much, and you end up at the almost the pinnacle, and you end up being a goat in the end, and nobody remembers anything hardly about what you did to get there. And I look at it as a great accomplishment to be second place. And maybe I'm justifying not winning, but I know it doesn't have the monetary rewards of winning. It doesn't have the glory of winning. It doesn't have the as big a ring as you get when you lose. But just to go that far is amazing. It really is. And it's a shame that we're such a society that just cares about the winner.
The teams
and individuals that get second place have done a lot to get there.
All right. I know when we talked about getting Ed on here, I said that was one of the favorite spots in the locker room that I love to go to, because I always know I got thoughtful, insightful comments, and we're getting them here. And since you mentioned his career, Ira, I'll say to listeners, he talked about Pro Bowls and All Pros. He was a four-time All-Pro-ler, Pro Bowler, four-time All-Pro as well. He was also an NFL champion, as he just mentioned. He played 241 games, which when he retired was the longest of any offensive lineman. I don't know that it still is, but it was the longest when he retired. Chosen to the Pac-12 All-Century team, but as a defensive lineman, not as an offensive lineman. I mentioned he did play defensive line in college. One of 11 players to participate in all four Vikings Super Bowls. He's in the College Hall of Fame, the Cal Hall of Fame, the Breitbart Hall of Fame, the Chargers Hall of Fame, the East-West Hall of Fame. I mean, he's also been chosen to the Vikings 40th anniversary team and the Chargers 50th anniversary team. So, Ian, I know you weren't really around when Ed was starring. He was a great player. He wasn't a good player. He was a great player. So, Ed, I'm going to ask you the leading question. Ira and I have been outspoken on your behalf for the Pro Football Hall of Fame. What are we missing, and what are Hall of Fame voters missing about Ed White?
Oh, man, well, you know, I'd be honored to be in the Hall of Fame. I know there's a lot of people that are pushing for that, and I'm grateful. But you know what? I might just be the second horse and everything, and it's like not winning the Super Bowl. I'm gonna just take a lot of pride in being second best. There's a lot of players. I'm doing a painting right now for George Kuntz, a buddy of mine that he played in LA at Loyola High School, and I played at Indio. We played in all the we played against each other at Cal and Notre Dame. And he's commissioned me to do, he's a lawyer in Las Vegas, and commissioned me to do a big painting for him. And so I'm working on that, and it's with a lot of joy that I'm doing that. And George is another one. George has been in like six Pro Bowls. Yeah. I'm going, well, yeah, hey, he's been in six. I mean, you know, it's when it's up to other people to decide, you know, who's doing this or that. And how many people honestly focus on the offensive line, you know, especially when we played, the cameras weren't like they are now. Today you get an end zone and I'm running things back for Joanna going, hey, look, this is what they're doing, blah, 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 blah. She's driving her crazy. She's trying to watch the game, but they show the end zone, the overhead, it's coverage of what's the entirety is so much better than it was when I was out there doing it. When they had one camera on the sideline and that's all you saw as a fan or anybody watching. And it wasn't, the focus was not on the offensive line. And so, you know, I think that's part of it too.
Yeah. George absolutely is Hall of Fame worthy. And so is a former teammate of his in Atlanta, and that's Mike Ken.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. And, there's a lot of guys out there that, you know, Nyland, John Nyland's another one,
absolutely.
You know, he, great offensive guard. Yeah.
Bob Kuchenberg's family's going through the same thing. Ed, Bob Kuchenberg's family.
Oh, Kuchenberg. I know. I love Bob. Bob and I would say hello to each other on the phone once a month. And that was unfortunate, but great player. Great player.
I got two quick ones for you, Ed. Thanks so much for your time, Ed.
All right. You
great
got
talking
it.
To you. Ed, you played against icons in the interior line. I'm talking about Lilly, I'm talking about Joe Green, Ed, and I'm talking about Merlin Olsen. Who gave you the toughest time, Ed?
Oh, boy, I'll tell you, all those guys were fantastic. And, you know, there were plays where I had a lot of difficulty and there were a lot of plays I didn't. And, but I got to tell you this, that it, as good as they all are, and they're all great, and Bob Lilly has become a great friend, super guy. And like I said, that was my first pro experience after, you know, 4 weeks in training camp as an offensive guard. And And I love the guy. The guy was amazing. But when I practiced against Alan Page every day, and Alan and I went pretty full speed on each other continually. And I mean, it was a game every day for me and for him. And in fact, Bud, later in my career, he called me in his office, says, "I'm moving you to right guard." I said, "Why?" He goes, "Well, you and Alan are beating each other up." And I went, and so, you know, Alan's not really, you know, ready to play as much on Sunday because you guys are just physically going at it too hard. And I said, and he said, "Plus, you'll get more notoriety playing next to Ranieri." And so, you know, that's what happened. And I moved to right guard, and that was the end of that story. And Ron's a great friend. In fact, he's going to be my next door neighbor in another week. So nice. The friendship continues.
Last one for me, Ed. And to me, an obvious one. Ed, I don't care if you were playing left guard or right guard. What was it like blocking in front of two guys with such disparate, personalities and the way they played as Fran Tarkenton and Dan Fouts, Ed? I mean, that is a big adjustment.
Well, it was. Fran was amazing. You knew that if you didn't make your block, you'd have another chance because he'd be scrambling somewhere else out of the pocket. So you never stopped thinking about coming back on a guy and Fran finding a way to get out of it. Amazing, quick athlete and very, very smart. And both Tarkenton and Fouts had that in common. They were both very intelligent guys and could think quickly. Fouts was surprisingly a good athlete. I was a pretty decent racquetball player and we played racquetball together. And he was a pretty good athlete, and which surprises probably a lot of people. He was lanky and a little bit slower moving around and didn't move in the pocket like Francis, but he had a genius about knowing exactly where his receivers were all the time. And he could get rid of that ball and find Joyner or JJ or Kellen or whoever, Wes Chandler. He knew where they were at, and they knew that they had to be ready to get a ball anytime. And he threw a good catchable football, and that's why he's in the Hall of Fame along with Fran. I tell people, I was lucky to be on a team that, you know, have a Hall of Fame quarterbacks, Hall of Fame coaches, and a lot of Hall of Fame players. And that I was very, very fortunate and blessed to be in that environment.
And speaking of which, you mentioned earlier, Don Coryell, as most people know, he's going into the Pro Football Hall of Fame this year in August 2023. Dan Fouts is on the coach contributor committee. I am as well. And when his name was announced, Dan was very emotional. I asked him afterwards, is that out of relief or was it out of pure joy? He goes, a little bit of both. When you heard that, when you heard that he was nominated and that he has in fact been elected and going in, what was your response? Were you emotional as well?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I had a special, I think, you know, it dates back from the fact that Don actually was probably the reason I ended up in San Diego. I know he was. And we became very, very good friends. I spent time with him up in his place in Washington on the island, in Hawaii on Molokai. And we were just great friends. He hired me. He didn't want to cut me, so he hired me as a coach. And so both Charlie Joyner and I, so we started coaching pro ball because Don, you know, put us on the staff. I was the assistant line coach and Charlie, right wide receiver coach. And he wore his heart on his sleeve and funny, laughed at himself and laughed at everybody else. And I'll tell a funny story. I told this, it's a bit on the edge, but anyway, we are in Denver playing for a championship at the end of the season. And we were in a room that was huge, conference room. And we had our little group of guys at one end, and he's up there. And he wore pants that were about 6 inches too short, as you recall. And they were spandex, you know, the age of the spandex pants. So he throws his leg up on a chair, and he's trying to then his cuffs came up to about his knee. So he's giving this speech and pulling the spandex down. And the essence of the speech was we had our backs up against the wall. And so he was going to illustrate that. But the wall was about at least 100 yards back in the corner. And so he's talking like, you know, old guy, you know, we're you know, like he talked. And yeah, a little lift, and we got our backs against the wall, and he's shuffling back, and he's so far back we can't hear him, and we're all cracking up. So Donnie and I had to hit the John after the meeting. So we're in the John, he's in one stall, I'm in the other, and we're laughing. I'm going, man, Coach was, and he, you know, he would drink wine during dinner and probably right. a little too much, and that would you know, add to the charm of his stories. But so we're sitting in there, and I'm going, Donnie, Coach was so messed up, he was just a gas, wasn't he? And on and on. All of a sudden, and he wore wingtips, these two wingtips show up underneath the door in my stall, and I'm going, oh my god. And I look over, and he's looking through the crack in the door, in there at me, and he goes, "Big Ed, you got to be careful. You never know who you're hitting next to." And I didn't know whether he was said meant sitting or, you know, the other. Anyhow, it was great. He was unbelievable. He was the opposite of Bud in terms of that.
Yep.
But Bud had all the other things, you know, it was great.
Great stories about Don. I mean, they're just legendary, and yeah. some of which have been told, most of which haven't been told.
I don't think that's been told a lot.
No, it hasn't. And at his memorial service, John Madden told another great one. I'm not going to go into it, but you ought to log on to it. A very poignant service. But John.
No, I was there. Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. And very, very emotional. A couple last things for me, Ed. One is just speaking of those Chargers teams, you had great teams there. The Air Coryell teams were great teams. You go to four playoffs, two conference championship games. You had that, I'd call it the Ice Bowl, but they called the Packers Cowboys game the Ice Bowl. But that game in Cincinnati, but you came so close in that game against the Raiders, where I think they controlled the ball like the last 6 or 7 minutes of it. But, huge disappointment, 79, I think, when you lost to Houston. Of those teams, which do you think was the most Super Bowl ready? The one that should have and probably could have and should have been in the Super Bowl?
Well, the Houston one, that we had a great team that year. And we got sidetracked into believing that, you know, Earl Campbell wasn't going to play, or Dan Pastorino, do you remember what? So it was a question of one of those guys playing or not playing. And it ended up they did play. And we I don't think we were mentally prepared for, you know, what happened. And so that, you know, that to me was the one that I think got cut short. And I don't think Dan particularly had a good day that day. I think there were several interceptions, and so
there are five of them.
Yeah, so that probably meant the offensive line didn't block that well that day. So I don't, you know, I don't remember the details. You know, you kind of put the bad stuff out of your mind. So yeah, yeah. I'm sure it was a combination of a lot of things.
Do you think that was the best of the four teams?
I thought so. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting thing after that game. I think it came out in Sports Illustrated where the Oilers apparently were tapped into, I think, the coaching booth, and were getting the plays. They knew what Dan was going to do, which would show on the field, because I think Perry had I hadn't heard that.
But anyway, wow.
And then lastly, because you did mention you're doing a painting for George Koontz, Ari, I'm sure you know this. Ed's a tremendous artist. He really is a great artist. I was a minor in art in college. Ed's a major in art. He's really good. And I heard a story that you once won an art contest at the age of 6, but you were disqualified because they thought it was traced. And you said, actually, it wasn't. It wasn't traced.
No, it was, yeah, you all remember when we were kids, they had, you know, draw the horse and win a scholarship to an art school.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so I did that, and I get this letter back, and they said, obviously, you traced this horse. I went, I did not trace that horse. And it upset me so much, I thought, well, I'm going to pursue art. And it's always been my real joy. I mean, you know, with all the brain stuff that's going on and all the guys, all my Viking teammates and several of the Charger offensive linemen, Russ Washington and Doug Wilkerson, you know, have gone the way of dementia and Alzheimer's. And this is something that I can do. And I go into my own world. And I was thinking the other day, I can have that and do this and be just fine.
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about. I've tried to steer our daughter in that same direction because it's so relaxing and you can do it for hours and it just seems like minutes. I'm also interested in your subjects because I look at what you've done and it seems like most of them are of nature. And I thought you really don't seem to do any of pro sports or portraits, but that obviously is not the case because you're going to do one of George Kuntz. Do you have a favorite medium and B, do you have a favorite subject? And I guess the favorite subject is nature, but I'll let you answer that.
Well, the favorite subject is whatever's on my heart at the time. Mm-hmm. I try to just do it out of emotion. I'm going to send you. Well, I'm going to try to send. The one I just did, it's called Conflicted Warrior. And it's a self-portrait of me in a Viking, half of a Viking helmet and half of a Charger helmet. Ah. And then I have all kinds of stuff. I'll send it to Ivor's number. I've got Ivor's number. I'll send that after we get off, maybe.
Okay. Have you done any Chargers?
Yeah. I've done. I did one of Fouts.
Oh, you did? Wow.
Yeah, I did a big one of him, and I've done the old Pittsburgh quarterback.
Bradshaw.
No. The more recent. Roethlisberger. Yeah. I did one of him, and yeah, I've done a few.
Wow, terrific. Yeah. Well, yeah. Ed, I can't tell you how much we appreciate having you on here and how good it is to speak to you again.
It's
been a while, but thanks so much for the time. Are you going to go back to Canton, by the way?
I am.
Oh, terrific. I may see you there. I hope I see you there. I really do.
Yeah, I would look forward to it. Yeah, the Chargers are taking a bunch of us guys, Donnie Masick and Charlie's going to go, obviously, but Dan will be there too. So there's going to be a bunch of guys that they're taking back. So
you'll have a good time there.
Yeah.
Ed, thanks so much for the time. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Clark. Good seeing you. Good talking to you. Ira, good talking to you. Ian, good talking to you. I didn't talk to you, but good seeing you. All right, guys. Thanks.
Take care, Ed.
Yeah.
That was former offensive lineman Ed White. And Ira, I mean, he does have a Hall of Fame case. And his name never comes up. But like he said, he's one of dozens. Kuntz is one. Ken's another one. There's so many. You mentioned Kuchenberg. I mean, you've got him in the senior pool. There's so many offensive linemen who are worthy who just can't get a sniff. But he's got a Hall of Fame qualified resume.
No question about it. The durability, the longevity, and doing it for two different systems, two different quarterbacks. Yep. And you covered him, Clark. You saw him game after game. He was one hell of a player.
One hell of a player and a better guy, as you just found out. A better guy.
Wait a minute. I hear something.
Yep. They're cheering. They're not cheering because Ed White has left. They're cheering because you're here, Ira, and you're here with, guess what? I was there. But I don't know where you were, and I don't know when you were, so tell me.
All right. I'm going to keep our Vikings theme going, Clark. So I got January 3rd, 1981. 24 degrees in Philly, Veterans Stadium, wind chill 14. Vikings, Eagles, NFC divisional round playoff game. Now, this is the 1980 Eagles. They had a heck of a team, Clark, even though they got beat by the Raiders in the Super Bowl. This is the week before they ended up playing Dallas, and they did a job on Dallas, their longtime nemesis. So here come the Vikings. And Philly's a 7-point favorite. Clark at home. They got a better team than Minnesota. You turn around, it's 14-0 Vikings. Now, Clark, you've been to the vet several times. When the home team's not doing well, that place is a snake pit. You can imagine. So the Boo Birds come out, and the home Eagles are down 14-0. And Clark, the rest of the way, 31-2.
Ooh,
Eagles.
Whoa.
Finals 31-16. And Clark, the story of the game is not too hard to discern. Tommy Kramer, and you were just talking about Fouts having a bad day. 5 picks for Kramer.
Ooh.
5. 8 Minnesota giveaways.
Ooh.
8. I don't know what the record is
hard to
for
win.
A team in a playoff game, but they gave the ball away, Clark, 8 times, and they were sent packing. You can't do that, Clark.
You can't do that. You can't do that. You're right about the vet. The vet was a whole nother experience, as you know. Ian may not, because I don't know if he's been there or not, or was there. But they had like a courtroom down in the basement because they ball off so many people in handcuffs and put them down there. It was unreal.
Hey, Clark, speaking of stadiums, Clark, talk a little bit about that that little poll you just put out among 5 or 6 of us. I'm the only one who voted for RFK because I like the open press box and you're freezing over there. But, Clark, Memorial Stadium was going to win that game.
It was. I mean, listen, I'm biased because I grew up a Colts fan. I used to see them there, and then I covered the Colts for a year. It was the world's largest outdoor insane asylum. People were nuts there, but they were nuts for the Colts. It wasn't a baseball town. It wasn't an Orioles town. It was a Colts town. Always was. They had one time, I think, a intra-squad scrimmage, and I think something like 50,000 people showed up. They were nuts for the Colts because of Unitas, Barry Moore, all those guys. They loved that team. And then Burt Jones follows Unitas. They loved that football team. There was so much history there, great games there. And when they left in 1984, and I was covering them then, they left in March of 1984, and we've talked about that. The owner, that was then Bob Irsay, he not only took the team out of town, he ripped the soul out of that city. He really did. And I don't really know that's ever recovered. I know that the Ravens are popular and they won a couple Super Bowls, but that team misses the Colts. They miss the history. They miss the players. They miss Memorial Stadium. They've got a better ballpark or better park down in the downtown area. That's a nice place. It's not Memorial Stadium. It was just great to go there, right off 33rd Street. They call the Gray Lady of 33rd Street. It was terrific. It was fun to cover games there. Clearly, you know, it is going to pass. Time outmoded it. But there were so many terrific games. There was a Packers-Colts game. It was played in the fog in Green Bay. I think Hornan scored 4 or 5 touchdowns. I think he scored 5 times. But when they played the Packers there, it was just outstanding. Then when they had the Giants 59 championship game, yeah, it was a great place. As I said, I'm biased. RFK, I understand, because I also lived in the Washington area growing up. My dad was in the service. And that place rocked. I mean, literally rocked. Ian, when people start jumping up and down, the stands move. You could feel it.
Clark, when Shula left Baltimore for Miami, was there an uproar locally? How come Shula?
There was a sort of feeling of betrayal. But I will say this. He was always held in high regard. I mean, he's a rock star in Baltimore to this day. Don Shula is held in such high regard. Not by John Unitas, however. Unitas didn't get along with him and said some pretty nasty things in a book that was published years ago. It's a great book called The GM. It's about basically about Ernie Accorsi. But I said to Ernie, oh, this book is about you. No, it's not. It's about GMs. Well, you're about 90% of it, so it seems like yours. But
was that about the Super Bowl, Clark?
No, it was
more in the Super Bowl?
No, it was about play calling. And I'm not going to take too much of your time here, but what happened was a game where Unitas said they're driving. It's like the fourth down, third down, whatever. They're driving for a touchdown and go ahead touchdown. And Shula sends in a play and Unitas changes it in the huddle and he calls his own play, throws a touchdown pass, and he comes off the field and Shula grabs him. Now keep in mind, Shula was 32 when he took that job. All right. He's a young guy. And he says to Unitas, don't you ever do that to me again. Unitas looked at him and said, you got that wrong. Don't you ever do that to me again. And that started. Unitas wanted to call his own plays, and he wasn't going to have a coach call him for him, especially a guy that young.
That's the way I feel about this podcast, Clark.
I know you do. I know you do. You're going to free agency. We're afraid we're going to lose you, Ira.
Fantastic guest.
Ed White is just terrific. I mean, he's terrific. He's a great, great guy, great player, but as I said, a better human being. I'm so glad you got him, Ira, and kudos to you for doing that. Hey, you have any final thoughts before we go?
Let's turn it over to Ian. His Bruins are in trouble. His Celtics are in trouble. What's going on, Glendon?
I think everyone wanted to hit the beach a little early this year. The weather is going to be nice, and summer starts in May. So let's go, Patriots.
Yeah, tell them you're talking Red Sox. Come on, Red Sox are okay.
I don't get into it until about June or July. I gotta wave smart through the beginning part. You know, I gotta save my energy.
You're absolutely smart. My brother said, don't get into it until August. And watching the last couple of years, I think he's absolutely right. Ira, since I mentioned baseball, I want to mention the passing of Ida Blue. He died this week at the age of 73. You remember him, so do I. Ian, not so much. But the New York Times said he was, quote, a baseball comment, unquote. And I can't agree more. Because the moment you saw him, Ira, you knew you were looking at a star. He was a great, great player.
That 1971 season, of course, people remember the All-Star game and, Vida Blue won 24 games that year and his ERA was like 1.75. Fuck, he was fantastic.
He was electric, just electric. And also had one of the greatest names ever in pro sports.
No question about it. That another big loss. Clark, seems like every day we're losing somebody memorable.
I agree with you. And you know what? We're going to lose this podcast right now because that's going to do it. If you'd like to hear this or any I Test for Two podcast, just go to our website, WITestFor2.com, or Ian's website, which we're on, called FullPressCoverage.com. Otherwise, you can tune in right here next week on the I Test for Two. Thanks so much for listening. We will see you then.